Hey, folks, welcome to a Not If But When, another Conversations on Crisis. Mike and I
are you having a crisis?
We're going to talk about some crisis and some crisis preparedness here, yeah.
Okay, so, well, take it away.
Okay, so last week we touched on the Fire Safe Council a bit and talked about some of the assets that they have on their website. Today we're going to talk about they have a project that they've been working on, and they're going to put on a wildfire evacuation and survival workshop for the public here in Santa Barbara at the Santa Barbara City College at the West Campus between 10 a.m. and 1 p.m. on the 18th of April, which is coming up here. I should say the 18th of May, I'm sorry. It's 18th of May, and it is coming up here, it'll be here before we know it. And what this is a symposium with a number of lecturers from the safety and the emergency services industry in Santa Barbara, both the Santa Barbara County, Santa Barbara City, Montecito Fire Department, CARP Summerlin, just about everybody has somebody that has some knowledge about this, and they're going to speak on different aspects of evacuation. And I wanted to just touch on some things this morning, things that I have, some feelings that I have about evacuation, some of the do's and don'ts and some of the problematic areas. And Mike, if you would, chime in here whenever you feel like it, if I get off on a rant.
And if I don't?
And if you don't, I'll just press on regardless and ignore anything.
Well, charge ahead.
From that side of the table.
Highball.
Right. So some of the do's and don'ts of evacuation. If you're able to, do have a scanner and learn how to use it. It'll tell you a lot about how the fire is being fought and where they are, and it's a little difficult to listen to the boots on the ground in the field and understand what they're talking about, but it doesn't take long before you start understanding what they're saying. And if you're in the in an area of a wildfire, or even if you're just on the perimeter, it'll tell you which way they'll talk about which way the wind is blowing, how heavily the flames are reacting, on what kind of slope it's burning. And then as the fire gets closer, if it does get closer, there'll be someone to come and knock on your door and tell you that it's time to evacuate, or the evacuation order has been given, or something like that. And at that point, you'll have a better idea of where it is that you're going to go when you leave the area, and what roads you'll take, and should definitely query any of the emergency service folks that come to your door and ask you to leave about where do they want you, and how do they want you to get to safety, because that fire is moving, and it changes direction often. And it impacts different roads that you're familiar with. You want to make sure you take a road that is not impacted by the fire. And so it's important to know where the fire is and where it's headed. And that's of paramount importance. And then some of the things you need to think about as you leave your house. What's happening? We're taking for granted that you are going to evacuate. You want to evacuate. The fire is close enough so you have some discomfort about its proximity. Understand that the fire authorities are going to tell you you have to leave, which is not really the case. If you're on your own property, as long as you stay on your own property, they don't really have any jurisdiction about whether you stay or leave. It's up to you. But if you decide to stay, then you should have strongly considered where you're going to seek refuge on your property as the fire comes and burns past you. Usually takes about 20 minutes, a half an hour for a fire to burn through an area. And at that time, the temperatures can get well over 1,200, 1,500 degrees. You want to make sure you're in some part of a dwelling or underground or something where you won't be impacted by those temperatures. The wind is going to be howling. There's going to be things crashing. Your house may actually catch on fire while you're in it. So you have to be prepared. Have a good clearing. Get your firewood away from the house. All the things that you can learn by talking to your local fire department. If you have got those all in place, no plastic furniture in the yard. Fiber mats at your doorstep is not a good idea because that can ignite your house easily. And then you go into the central part of your home that has hopefully no windows, is insulated, or say down in the basement in a lower level or something where you're below ground. You just take refuge there until the fire has passed by. And you want to pay close attention to the passing of the fire, because after it has passed, what you want to do is you want to get outside and put out whatever fires may have started on your roof because of leaves that have aggregated there, or a porch that has caught on fire. And you can often stop the fire from burning and doing much damage to your house the sooner that you can get to it and address those problems. Mike, you got anything there that you add?
Well, I think that, one, we want to stress that we're not advocating people stay, especially ones that shouldn't stay.
No, absolutely.
Two, there is just a lot of video available that you can watch of fires overrunning homes and neighborhoods and whatever. And I would encourage people to take a look and watch some of those and then ask yourself the obvious questions. Could I put up with that? Am I ready to deal with that? Is that something that I'm prepared for? The heat and the smoke are two things that don't come across in video, and it's a huge factor.
And noise is a huge noise.
It's unrelenting. And the other aspect of this that's important is that you decide to stay, and then suddenly you change your mind. It's kind of like being on a roller coaster. Once you're heading up to the top, you own it, and you got it. And the likelihood of somebody coming in there to get you is slim to none. The idea that you'll push your luck up to a point and then somebody's going to come and save you, that is bad planning.
Well, absolutely. I think that you really need to have an understanding of what the fire is going to do, or at least have witnessed some, as you say, some video or something about that.
Well, I know with some of the last fires we were interviewing, well, when we did the Thomas fire and the Tea fire, you and I were on the air and we were talking to the experienced, seasoned wildland firefighters that had done it for a career. And they were talking about the fire behavior being far excess of what they'd ever seen before in their careers, and that they would reevaluate whether or not they themselves would stay and protect their home in the future.
Or protect the homes.
Yeah, it's just, I just can't stress it enough. Until you've been through it, you don't know what you don't know, and there is a lot you don't know, and it can kill you. And it's strange to me that people are willing to put so much at risk because of convenience or what have you. Now, on the other hand, we know that staying and defending your home is a great way to make sure you still have a home. So I'm not dismissing either side of this, but I'm just trying to just drive home the fact that you really need to think about this. This is a serious decision. And if you're going to stay and defend, and you are going to stay and shelter in place, those are things that you need to figure out how you're going to do it long before the fire gets there.
Well, what we're trying to do is to take a look at the difference in the threat of staying and sheltering in place and getting out on the road and getting into a position where you run into a traffic jam.
Oh, yeah.
And the smoke of the fire is approaching and there's nowhere for you to go. So I think that the authorities are taking a closer look at that as well these days. And hopefully, out of this symposia that we're going to have on the 18th of May, we'll be able to develop some some ideas with the county or with the agencies that where people can get better educated instead of just saying, well, you don't really know what all this is about. Well, how can I find out what it's
there
about?
There is a ton of information out there. People don't want to access it.
But the thing is that it's like looking at a volume of encyclopedias that are on the similar subjects and trying to find the right information, you know, or trying to find someone that has been through a similar situation. And the difference between evacuating a home that's on a well-paved street in the middle of a subdivision and a home that's a quarter of a mile off of any highway on a rough dirt road, big difference. And I think that one of the things that folks can do that I think is really important and is a great asset is to get one of the individuals or a couple of individuals from the closest fire department. Doesn't matter who it is, but as someone that's in your area that where there's a fire station, could be Forest Service, could be County Fire, could City Fire, and get them, and they will be more than willing to come to your property and walk around on your property with you and look at and tell you where the dangerous areas are, which direction the fire most likely will be coming from, how you can do extra clearing in those areas, look at your house and say, well, you know, there is some debris up there on your gutters. You need to do some more work there. Just things that maybe you'd be missing, but because they're professional.
Well, now that there's mandated inspections, they will be coming to your house whether you want them there or not.
Well, and not only that, but the Fire Chief Council provides free.
They're doing the same thing.
And they have a really comprehensive checklist. It takes about 45 minutes for them to go around your house and look at all the aspects. They will give you their findings. You won't be cited or you won't get any trouble for things that they find that are dangerous. But at the same time, it's ammunition that you can use to further protect yourself and your family.
Well, the insurance companies will do the same thing. In fact, they're doing it with drones and Google Earth and what have you.
But you know, the drone thing, I mean, I think the drone is a little bit, I mean, it's a tool, but you can't take a look at, closely look at a piece of property from 50 feet in the air. You know, you can get an idea. You can see where the different types of plants are growing and how thick the brush is in different areas and that sort of thing. Yeah, it's a good tool, but I don't think that it's adequate. I think you need to have more information.
Well,
especially if you're planning on staying with your home.
I don't disagree. They're not going to invest that much time into it because they're looking at not just your house, but they're looking at the surrounding area. So your house may be photo perfect. And get a straight A on your evaluation, but your neighbors around you are at C or below. That's going to factor into your survivability.
Correct.
Excuse me. Correct. So this is why it's got to be a community effort. And, you know.
Well, there's so many facets to this thing. The thing that I've found is that the more information that you have, the better prepared you are, and you can make an application to your property more readily with better with the information that you can gather from people that have been there before you, and no situation is the same exactly as another situation, but at the same time you can get good information, especially from the firefighters that have fought fires in your area and have some knowledge about it. Talk to them, get them to come by your property and take a look at it. There's a couple of other things I'd like to touch on before we move on to some. Don't drive into smoke if you can possibly avoid it, because the impression with smoke across the road is that it's clear just beyond the smoke, and you can drive through it and get to the other side quite readily. Well, often that is absolutely the opposite of the case. You drive into the smoke, it gets denser and denser, and pretty soon there's living fire in there that's burning, and the information that you have about that road being open is erroneous, or things have changed by the time you get in the car and you head out. So don't drive into smoke. If you see heavy smoke in front of you, not only that, but your gasoline-powered car will not operate efficiently with smoke in the air, heavy smoke, you find that it won't run, that it'll stop.
Yeah, it'll
leave
you up.
Stranded in the middle of smoke with no knowledge of where the fire is coming from. So it's just not a good idea. Another thing is that stay in your vehicle. Don't try to jump out of your vehicle and outrun the fire, because that fire is moving faster than you can possibly run. And many, many people, even people that are well-versed in fire behavior and fire chiefs and fire officers and things, have lost their lives.
Well, there's certainly a big history of that. And you can't outrun a fire. Plus, if you're running, you're bringing in more bad air than you would otherwise. So you're just compounding your problem. And most fire fatalities are a result of people, civilian ones, are a result of them trying to escape the fire, including Painted Cave. Same thing on Old San Marcos. So, you know, trying to run away from one of these things because you got trapped or caught up into it or whatever, this sure is not the plan.
And we haven't, thank goodness, we haven't had very many fire fatalities in the 50 years or 60 years now that I've been living in that area. I can only remember a couple of people that have been burned. And we've had a lot of fires.
Looking back, because I've been up there since 91, but you've got a lot more time up there than I do. But I don't remember evacuations ever really being a problem. What's been a bigger problem is the looky-loos coming up to get up there before.
Let's take a look at that. Let's take a look at that, the evacuation and the problems that are attended with it.
Right.
Most often when the authorities tell you that you have to leave the area, there's a lot of things that they don't tell you about leaving the area. One thing is that once you get off of your property, you're in their jurisdiction, and they have
They won't let you back up.
They have jurisdiction over your move. They can take you away if you're not on your own property. If you're on your own property, you have absolute right to be there. So the idea is that we are not told as much as we need. This is something I'm going to try to bring out at this symposium, that we need to have better information about what it is we're being asked to do. And because if you leave, not only will you be away from your home when the fire gets there, and most often no one's going to be there at all to take care of your home, but also it'll be a week or 10 days if you have a fire come through that community and burn a bunch of houses before you can get home again.
Potentially, yeah.
And they never let you know that. They don't tell you if you leave that you're out of there for days, not hours. And I don't know of a fire that people have evacuated from and that have gotten back into their homes in less than a day. I'm not aware of that. So people need to have that in mind, and that's another reason for staying and not leaving. But if you plan to stay, again, make sure that you understand that you can't leave if the fire is approaching and you can smell the smoke and see the flames. You can't run out and jump in your car and drive away.
It's too late.
You're putting yourself in severe danger. So those are some of the things. And there's a lot of other things that I haven't touched on here, but come to this wildfire evacuation and survival workshop on the 18th of May at Santa Barbara City College on the West Campus for 3 hours plus. I think they're going to have there's going to be food there. They're going to have a number of speakers that know what they're talking about. There'll be a question and answer period, of course. There'll be hopefully time to listen to your observations and get a good answer to your questions. And it starts at 10 a.m. and it's going to officially end at 1 p.m., but I'm sure that there'll be a lot of conversation that goes on after that. And what's happening, hopefully, is it will get a large group of like-minded people that have good questions about mm-hmm. what the situation they're looking at when they evacuate their home. And so that's May 18th at the Santa Barbara City College West Campus from 10 to 1. And I think it's a very worthwhile 3 out of 4 hours.
No fee? It's free?
It's free to the public. Except
parking?
And the parking is free.
Okay.
And there will be refreshments. And I think it's going to be a good event. And I don't know I don't know whether different agencies are going to have different tables and that sort of thing, or whether it's simply going to be coming to the auditorium and sit down and witness the presentation and then ask questions. I'm not sure how that's all going to play out. And when we get closer to it, I'll find out and okay. We'll have a better idea.
Okay. You know, one of the things that I would want to stress is the importance of having emergency planning in the planning that cities and counties, municipalities do for building and for roads and for lighting and for all of the activities. They need to be focusing on emergency and evacuation first, and they don't. So it's not even considered in many cases. And it certainly is demonstrated in the way cities are choking roads up. That's not going to facilitate rapid evacuation, whether it be a fire, weather-related,
earthquake,
You know, whatever. And we have a good share of real emergencies here in Santa Barbara. They don't make them up. And the necessity to get people out and other people in is real. And if we look at the history of Paradise, we can see the importance of having roads open. And yet that's not the mantra that we're listening to.
Well, in Santa Barbara City, it's been 10 years now, I guess, but they did a really good evacuation drill on the Riviera.
Oh, yeah.
And it was very successful. And actually, there were several fires that came right after that, and people knew what they needed to do.
That was very successful. Yoli put that together, and we participated in that, yeah. And it was good. You were talking about information, and that's one of my pet peeves, as is yours, because I don't think we're any farther down the road on information than when we were when you and I started getting cranky about it. If anything, we might even be worse because there's less media resources out here today than there was before. And what media does exist isn't local, mm-hmm. and it's almost all automated. And I can tell you, having worked in a radio station, there's nobody there. There's not going to be anybody there. So when you talk about what's the fire doing, where is it going, whatever, they're going to be playing whatever's playing in the program. That's it. That's all you're going to get.
And the authorities that are on the fire are concentrating on putting the fire
and
out.
And they do not prioritize the PIO function. No. And I was in a meeting just last week, and I was listening to a discussion that has been on again, off again for over 15 years on this information thing. And I don't even listen anymore. I mean, I what for? I'm hearing the same thing just from different people about the same problems for which there is no conscientious interest in resolving. Otherwise, they would have by now. And there's no money to pay for it, which is,
well,
of course,
one of
a buggy book.
You don't see us having any evacuation drills is because the agencies can't afford to pay for them.
But I submit that you don't need a lot of money for some of these things. It's attitude and it's culture and it's priorities. I mean, what does it take to get somebody to tell you what's going on? It's not going to happen. It's got to be sanitized and processed before anybody's going to say squat. Hence the reason that we are big advocates of radio scanners. I mean, you can just listen to the traffic, It's there. And you can tell in people's voices, when you listen to public safety agencies, you can tell when the voices start getting amped up and people are starting to get... When you have professionals starting to get worried, that's when you should definitely be worried. So I'm a big advocate of if you live in a hazardous area, whether it be fire, earthquake, weather, you go back east, a lot of people have scanners because of the weather, the tornadoes and what have you. Down in Florida and Texas, it's hurricanes. So it's not unusual. And the wildfire stuff, the NOAA has been... kind of vacillating on the issue of putting out fire weather stuff on the NOAA paging systems mm-hmm. that people have back east. I'm a big advocate of doing that, but they're getting better at putting stuff out on the cell phones. But again, it requires somebody be there. And many of these communication centers are understaffed and the response is understaffed. And this is not the priority. They're worrying about their own people right now. So there are private organizations, amateur radio being one of them, that have camera systems up, and they have their own communications outreach. But they, too, they're volunteer-based. It's dependent on people being available and not being in the victim pool themselves, and that their equipment is up and running. And we're seeing the demise of some of that simply because hilltops are being cleared off for political reasons, and therefore the infrastructure that supports all that is going away. So we're not seeing more, we're seeing less. In an era where we have all this technology, which then drives people to third-party news sources, many of whom are nothing but emotional mouthpieces of misinformation or misperceived information or rumor mongering, or you know, it's not reliable. So, hence, I'm just a big believer of scanners. But they get abused as well.
Well, I mean, anytime that you have someone that's giving an impression of what's going on the other end, and you're not able to see what it is right. they're talking about, you know, it's. But it's just another tool and more information.
I mean, it goes back to my other pet peeve of news versus entertainment.
Yeah, infotainment.
And what do you need to know and what do you want to know? It's two different criteria. And oftentimes people want the entertainment value out of it. They don't necessarily care about the specifics.
Well, you know, it's follow the money, you know, and entertainment is where the money is, so...
Well, now, yeah, and then with YouTube being monetized like it is now, more and more people are doing that. And some folks are very successful with YouTube, and then they discover they got to pay taxes on it, but that's another story. But even YouTube, to have something that people will actually watch has to have some credibility to it, and it has to have some substance of value, some sure. production quality. And, you know, that gets down to personalities and who do you want to watch and who do you not want to watch and who sounds like he's got it together and who doesn't, that kind of thing. There are some great news sources out there that are done by private individuals, by people that clearly have the background and the experience.
The sad thing is that because the Internet has gotten so filled with opinion and paranoid responses and things that people are getting away from watching anything.
Can you blame them? I don't watch any of it.
You can't blame them. And you're saying, you know, there's some great people out
there. There are.
But how do you know whether they're any different from all the rest of the people that aren't so great? I mean, it's all about, you know, how forceful they are and how convincing their conversation is, that sort of thing. But you don't really know whether you're getting good information or not, you know. And you can't spend a lot of time, you know, reviewing the personality of the individual that's talking to.
Now, there's some truth to that, but my experience seems that you can tell pretty quickly if somebody's got the right kind of background to be talking about whatever it is they're talking about. I watch a lot of that kind of stuff for training and education and just awareness and trying to make things better on what I'm doing. And I have my own personal criteria of what I want or don't want. I watched one the other night. I do a lot of aviation viewing. And there was a guy on there. He was, I think he was with Southwest. And he's a Southwest pilot. And obviously, he's a pilot. And he's got the vernacular, and he's doing his thing. But boring. And he's talking about the same stuff that I can get from other guys that are not boring talking about the same thing. So presentation has a lot to do with it.
A lot of it.
You know, the Jack Webb thing works great in some formats, but it's not going to work well in others. And so, and then knowing your audience and what kind
of
format.
All of it.
That's why I think having multiple people together is more of a better presentation, because they may not like my presentation, but they like yours or, you know, what have you.
That's why on our podcasting, you know, I think it's really valuable for us to have other individuals that come in, and when you have two or three people as opposed to one or two people, three or four people talking, then you get a much broader look at what the subject matter is, and it makes a difference. It really does. And that's
now certainly credibility goes a long way, and most of these people have zero.
Well, I think what's happening is that to a great extent, people are credible until and you're listening to them and taking whether what you say. But a lot of times it's the Peter principle comes into effect. You know, they get to the limits of their credibility, and they will continue to talk and to give you information that ends up not being credible.
Well, that's saturated.
But that's just.
But as soon as they start bringing in politics or the president this or the mayor that or the governor or whatever, I turn it off because right then and there they've gone off the scale.
Yeah. Well, I think there's a lot to that, you know. But usually, if you listen, if you're discerning. You can pretty much tell what someone's politics is if you're listening to what they have to say, you know.
Or that they don't have any. It's a nerd.
Yeah.
So, that's.
Well, anyway, I think that, you know, this evacuation thing is really important, and I'm glad to see there's some attention. I'm not convinced that we're going to get everything we want, but I think it's a great start, and I think that we should be participating in this and working with it. And there's so many subjects that are similar that we should be taking a look at. Access, obviously defensible space, hardening of the homes, which is a huge thing these days, and how to make your home so that it'll better stand up to a wildfire when no one is there. And that's pretty tricky.
It has to defend itself. House has to defend itself for a structure. It doesn't have to just be a house.
Yeah, I think that was your...
Ronnie Coleman's position on that was... Yeah. And, you know, that he was fire marshal a long time ago, and that mantra has stuck. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a good tagline. Every house needs to defend itself. But that's easier said than done.
Well, there's so many factors that the houses need assistance, you know, because... there can be an aggregation of debris on your roof that you cleaned your roof off 3 months ago, and yet you don't realize it, but there's been some winds and some things have aggregated, and that can burn your house down really easily. And you were just up there, seems like just the other day, and you feel as if you're in good shape.
So I was interviewed by the FirstNet people in Washington, D.C., and they asked about evacuation. That was a question, and what we were doing and how FirstNet supports that and whatever. And I went and I said, well, one of the things that I've been promoting personally as I give these discussions is an evacuation list, your 10-minute list, and you've got time to get organized list, your 1 hour list. So the things that you have to have available and what you're going to do and when you just got to bug out and you got less than 10 minutes to do it. And then the extended list. And they had not thought of that, but they thought that was a good idea too. And I said, you know, you just have it by the front door or wherever, and then you go. But one of the first things is to close the doors and the windows, because we've seen homes that are otherwise textbook perfect, burned to the ground because of something as simple as an open window.
Window or an open vent.
Yep.
There's so many. As soon as the fire can get into the house, and it's like rodents. If there's a way, it'll find.
But you think about that for a second. You get your average Santa Barbara house. If you get your checklist off the door and the fire's coming up the hill and you go, I got to close all the doors and windows, well, that just took all the time that you have to go do whatever else you think you need to get done. 10 minutes isn't very much time. And I just picked that as an arbitrary, easy-to-remember thing, 10 and 60 or, you know, some sales pitch type of thing like that. But because you got the dog and the cat and the bird. And
well, that's why practice is something that's important. And I think that people should be practicing so that they find out how long it does take them to do the chores that need to be done immediately upon an evacuation order. And if they don't know, then they don't know. And so this way it'll give them an idea of how much time they need. And then they can make better choices about what it is that they're going to do before they leave and still get out safely.
So. It's also important that not all fire is bad and not all fire is going to take you out. And it's very intimidating. I think when I got into the fire world or even in the law enforcement side, and you'd see some of these hellacious fires, and When you're young and dumb and you don't know any better, it's scary and it's intimidating and whatever. But it's very impressive how fast you can knock a lot of fire down. And it's not all the time, but it's amazing what they can do. And so I'm not encouraging people to bet on that. But, you see some of these 60, 70-foot flame links coming up. You got to think of that. Is that on a flat surface or is that on a slope? Because that suddenly is going to be 150-foot flame links, you know. And it's going to reach out and touch you a lot quicker. But, if you've got your space clearing, you're not going to have that impingement.
That's why it's important to get information from the firefighter. Have the firefighter come to your property and talk to you about your hillside and which way it's going to come from and how much vegetation you have in different areas. And another benefit of having the local firefighter come to your property is that he will remember that you had him come there, and on the event of an emergency, he's going to know how well prepared you are because he helped you prepare himself. You know?
We also have to keep in mind that when the mutual aid environment kicks in, the who might be parked in your driveway could be Beverly Hills, Long Beach, LA City, whomever.
But you don't want to plan on that. You want to plan on your own knowledge and preparation.
Well, it gets complicated fast, and when you're talking about having to bug out and get out of the house in 10 minutes or less, that's a tall order, and you guys should practice that. And the other thing that we see up on the hill is kind of a reverse of that, where people are racing to get up the hill so that they can get on their property before the roads get closed, because there is an envelope of time there, and generally that centers around animals, more often than not, the dogs, cats, horses, things like that, because the folks are working down the hill, and then all of a sudden they see smoke at the top of the hill, and that's where they want to go. So that has been a challenge as well.
So, well, I think, that has to do with just being remote. But what's happening is people have to understand that when they're racing to get up the hill to do whatever they want to do on their property, the agencies are racing up the hill to put the fire out. And so you're sharing the road with some people that are really taking some chances both ways. And so
it's a problem.
It is a problem. And there's a lot of those things that are that crop up, and sometimes it's no problem. I mean, sometimes the fire, the wind changes the whole story. It can either be better or worse.
Well, we have a horse, okay, and we got a trailer for the horse. And the purpose of the trailer is to evacuate the horse. That's what it's for. But who's going to tow it? Who's going to be there to deal with it? And if you're messing around with the horse, who's scared and panicking and jumping around and making noise and everything, you're not doing anything else. It becomes labor intensive. And then who's going to put them in the trailer and who's going to drive the trailer down the hill? And now we've got a project, and this is a project that's going to take some time. And I don't have an easy answer for that, because if I'm not at home, it's not going to be me.
Well, fortunately, you don't live in the chaparral. You live in a closed canopy oak woodland, mm-hmm. which is a completely different
animal. Yep.
And and it burns in a different way, and it has a lot less potential to go wild on you. It can, depending on how much dead material is in those trees. And
but most of that dead material has ironically come out because of the winds we've had.
Well,
no, that's
absolutely.
But you tell that to the insurance company. They just see green.
I'm just thinking about when you go to get your horses in that trailer in the oak woodland, you're not having to worry quite so much as you do as if you're down on the south slope.
Exactly.
Come out of the chaparral.
The other thing is that I think that anything that gets going in the Paradise 154 Lake Kachuma area that comes across the valley floor, it's most likely going to kind of parallel up a Fremont Trail and head up into the saddle and come into the East Camino Cielo in the 5500 block and blow through the saddle up there at the S-curves. And that's the most reasonable, logical, wind-driven event. The prevailing winds coming out of Lompoc, which is something I look at, I'm not in the path of. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting, when you start looking at the physicality of the fires that we've seen, But we've seen fires coming from the east and going to the west, and we've seen people fires coming from the west and going to the east, and then you've seen fires that are headed east, and then they swing completely around and start coming back to the west. I mean, it's very difficult because in the mountains, a little change in the weather or of the wind will change dramatically which way that fire is going to move, and it's very difficult to project what that is by just looking at the...
Well, you know, the Santa Barbara is incredibly blessed by having some extraordinarily well-experienced wildland firefighters, both within the Forest Service and Santa Barbara County, Santa Barbara City. You know, most of the guys at the city that have really got their stuff dialed in came from the Forest Service. But these folks are retiring out. And the knowledge of what these big fires have done in the past is going away. Now they're on maps and stuff, but it's different. You don't have the tactical experience of what it's like to be up on the ridgelines. And the new folks aren't going to get that kind of experience. Cause
you know, I have a different feeling about it because I think that what's happening is the whole game of fire, wildfire, is changing so radically because of the way things are drying out and the climate is changing, that there's a tremendous amount of interest and education as to what produces what kind of results, you know. And now we've got people that are studying the wind patterns in the mountains, you know, just looking at the wind from different, you know, I mean, there's...
Well, the money game. There's so much money being made in these fires. They're not always going to admit it, but there is. And it's a business like anything else, and there's costs associated with being ready for them. So somebody's got to pay, and the dynamics of all of that's starting to change. And we're getting back to doing more prevention work, large-scale fuel management programs. The nonsense of the last 20 years is starting to be put away, and we're going back to what we know works. And I think that's being driven in large part by the collapse of the insurance coverage in California. If you can't get insurance, how do you sell your house? I understand there's a lot of homes starting to pop up on the market here on the South Coast, and the insurance is the driving force behind it. But the insurance problem doesn't go away just because you put your house up on the market. You still got to disclose it. And even if you don't, your potential buyer, unless they're completely doing it with cash and not asking any questions at all, are going to find it out themselves. How do you get insurance? It has catastrophic effect.
We've definitely got a lot of things ahead of us that are going to be changing the way we perceive property ownership and the responsibilities that go along with it and the expenses that go along with it.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that is coming down the pike at us. But
I want to ask you a question about that because I was in another conversation here recently and we were discussing, something's going to change. Obviously, there's change in the air and it's being pushed by the insurance industry in large part. What are they pushing towards? And I presented the concept of business owners, having to be more self-insured than they currently are, that you have to be able to cover your losses up to a certain point, and then you would have what essentially would be reinsurance. And that's when the big boys come in and they cover your additional losses if you care to have that. But that the responsibility of taking care of one's property is going to increase substantially. And how to pay for that within.
So what's your question?
Well, does that make sense to you that that's where it could very well be heading, is that the owners are going to have to start fending for themselves?
I think they are, but I think that it's a much, much larger problem than simply the inability to get your property
for sure.
Insured. There's so many factors that are coming to play that are going to be coming at us in the next 10, 15, 20, 30 years that we're looking at the change is going to be so radical. And that's why I think that the people that came up through the Forest Service or the fire prevention and the firefighters in the last 30 years, say, are going to be so vastly different in the next 30 years because of all these the considerations and changes in tactics and abilities and you know, the... I mean, how long have we had compressed air foam? I mean, it hasn't
been around a long time.
Yeah, But we're going to see that there are going to be other things that are going to be added and used. And I mean, I think that the science of suppression of fire is changing, and the ability for aircraft to draw water from a lake, or you know, by just flying along the surface of the lake and scooping up water, it has been going on for about 20 years, but they're getting better and better at that, and faster ways of getting the water.
Well, the tactics currently are basically surround the fire and contain it, versus let the fire come to you, which is kind of the tactic that I would have is, why am I trying to circle this thing through the canyons and stuff? Let this thing run up to the top of the ridge lines where we can contain it there. Now, it's not that they don't do those things, but if we box the hills up like they used to, the fire's already in a box. It's already contained. It just hasn't gotten to the line yet. Whole different tactic, and you can put those in at your leisure.
Well, I can remember fires that I was on back in the 60s and 70s. Where the fire, and these were when we did a lot more of
the burns,
burning areas off and ratchet burning and stuff like that. And the fires, a different fire, you try to start the fire and it take you until 11 o'clock to get the fire to actually burn the area. And then the sun comes over the ridge and the next thing you know, that fire is headed.
Yeah, it's ferocious.
Off into the distance, you know. And we lost a lot of fires until finally now the prescribed burns are not, if anywhere close to people's homes on the South Coast, are just not being accepted.
Well, and that's understandable, risk management on that kind of thing, and the what-if scenarios, and well, what kind of staffing you have.
You talk strongly about insurance, you know, yeah. And the difficulty and getting settlements from the insurance companies and all the time factors that are involved. And oh my God. So, there's just so many problems involved. And I think what we need to be paying the most attention to, you and I, and that is how do we keep the public safe? How do we educate the public so that they are safe? Not trying to figure out how the economics of
Brian, well, we've been beating this drum for, 16, 17 years?
15, a little over 15.
Whatever it is.
Anyway, yeah.
And we're still pretty much the only two doing it. We've seen people come and go, and we've seen grant programs and what have you. But the consistency of putting the word out there and trying to get folks to think and approaching it from a variety of different aspects, and the investment part of it is just one. And when was the last time anybody came up and said anything to you about what we've been doing?
I don't think anyone ever has.
Exactly.
You know, and I, a lot of times I feel as if they're just placating us, you know, let the children,
I have no doubt.
And we just go ahead and do what we want. And if it makes them feel good, let's let them go. You know,
I have no doubt there's people that think that, and it's been pretty benign and harmless. We're doing columns in the paper for 2.5-3 years, whatever, a long time. We did columns on this, and I've written for a variety of different magazines on top of that. And it's not that anybody hasn't heard it or paid attention to it. Then you look at Ready, Set, Go. That's a very well-funded program.
I learned a long time ago that nobody cares until there's smoke in the air.
Until it's too late, yeah.
And that's just human nature. And we're dealing with human nature in all its different facets when we're dealing.
So if that's true, and I believe you're correct, maybe the investment needs to be in having a lot of resources for information immediately available when there's smoke in the air, because that's when people will care and pay attention, which was the whole concept of what EPIC was about. And it's kind of coming back a little bit, so I'm told. But we had over 100 PIOs that all knew how to get a hold of each other.
The thing is that the bridge from the PIO to the public was not as effective as it should be.
Now I think it was a media issue.
Well, there's issues.
Because where's the distribution?
There's issues. I mean, that's just what it is. But the thing is that you guys got an incredible system working. Right. and lots of communication with a lot of
all
different
died
entities
off.
That have never actually communicated together.
Yep.
But there was a big gap between them and the person on the street or the person on the porch or whatever. And whether it has to do with the way that the material was presented or what the, you know, the means of presentation or the language that was used or who knows what it was, but it never got there, you know, and that was a shame.
Well, now you don't have a newspaper. You don't have hardly any live radio in Santa Barbara. If it is live radio, it's not coming from Santa Barbara. You have three TV stations all owned by the same person, just basically simulcasting one show with an extraordinarily limited number of people. To
and most of the media sources that are written media sources, there's only a couple that actually are dealing with public information and things that people are interested in. Well, and then you have the exclusive. In Santa Barbara, it's in a very exclusive community. Most of the magazines and most of is all talking to the people that control the finances. You know, that sort
sure.
of thing. And so, and the person that where the information really is in the computer world online. And some people know how to get to it and do really well at it. Other people have no knowledge whatsoever. I mean, it's a whole part of the public.
We talked about this years ago when Next Door came out.
Yeah.
Now, Next Door, I was a big supporter of it at first because I think it's brilliant because you can go by specific areas within a specific zip code and it has a local control within that group. And whatever, but even that got hijacked by the crazies.
Well, and it's just that the people that really want to get attention for one reason or the other.
But that dilutes the usability and the viability.
Does, it does, and that's what you're going to find, you know. And people don't want to take the time to sort their way through it, you know. But I, you know, I find it still a great. Well, of course, I organized the
right. You started ours up there.
It got it going, but now what it's turned into is it's a big swap meet, and then it's a big a grievance committee situation.
Yeah, and it's gossip, and it's just. Now, having said that, obviously, if a fire breaks out up there, it's going to be of some use just by default.
Of course.
But you look at all the different platforms that are available today that people can get information and news out. There is no way that any agency is going to feed them all. Now, there are some systems or programs that you can get that will feed a majority of them simultaneously. But it becomes too daunting. It's like, I can't play to every. It's like having to have 15 different language skills. You got to talk to 15 different languages to all these people who I won't listen to this, but I'll listen to that. I won't read your newspaper, but I'll listen to his blog or, you know, whatever. Everybody's got their flavor.
Well, everybody's selective. There's a lot.
It's not like it used to be where everybody just would go to Channel 7 or 4 or 2 and watch the news.
Everybody picked up the paper and, you know, sat
there. No, that's gone. You're not going to do that either. And even when we had a paper, there's no reporting staff available to go out and give you anything. Some of the papers in Ventura are taking automated submissions. So somebody at home.
So now we've got IA to deal with, you know, and some of the things that are coming across that, you know, how are you going to.
At least it writes better than the people that. I mean, I read some of the stuff that there's written in paper. It is deplorable. You would think that people who have a journalism degree could at least have taken an English class. And it's just, I don't know, man. It's a whole different world out there. And to complain about it is a waste of time.
Well, nobody wants to hear complaints. What they want to hear is solutions.
Well,
and that's where our job.
But as soon as the solution's presented, now it's going to cost some money or it's going to require engagement. And that's another aspect of this that we've hound on, is that if you're one of those people out there who want information, well, then you've got to engage the process because nobody's going to spoon feed it to you. And there's a lot of information out there. We just had this conversation with the cell phone companies. They were all upset because they didn't know about the site being removed up here in Santa Barbara, and I'll save that for another day. But it's going to impact about 15 miles of coastline, people are going to lose their cell phone coverage. I mean, that's an evacuation issue in itself. And they were claiming we didn't know. Well, you're one of the biggest corporations in the world. How can you not know what's going on in your client
base?
That's
a problem. That's a big problem, is because they're looking at a much larger scale, and they don't realize the change begins at the bottom.
That's right. And so now all of a sudden they've got a major problem.
Sure.
And this does impact on
it. Actually, I think it's good. I think it's a good problem because it's going to put attention in an area that needs it, you know. So they start realizing that the macrocosm creates the larger picture, so that you have to look at all of it in order to really be able to understand or predict how.
You're right. Nobody cares until there's smoke in the air, and that goes with emergency programs and policies and procedures for day-to-day operations, including running communication systems, including running media. I mean, you can't even get a generator in this town. You got to have permits. They won't give you permits. So there goes your emergency planning right there, because you have no IT. You have no phones. You have no nothing, because you have no power. Well, that's a huge problem. And so, you know, it's power and water and sewage and food, you know, these are the fundamentals that you're going to have to deal with.
That's what our job is to break it down into bite-sized chunks so that people understand, you know, how much water they need to have water for a certain time, and how much food they need, and what sort of food do they need, and how are they going to cook that food.
But as soon as you start talking about this stuff, Ted, people turn it off. They don't want to hear it. It's not happy talk. It's not, you know, the kinds of things that people want to deal with, and yet you're trying to...
Well, that's what we always run into, is that people are interested in fire behavior and fire... anything to do with wildland fire for about 30 days. And it stays in people's minds, and there's a time to... But at the end of that 30 days, unless there's another fire that comes right on its heels, it's like they move on, and then it's another thing. It's like the rain. You know, people are, you know, oh, my God, when is it going to start raining? You know, we need the water so much and the rain. And then all of a sudden the rain comes, and it's like... Oh, my God, when's the rain?
We saw that with the tea fire. The tea fire came in, did its thing, and then everyone slept easy thinking, well, we had our big fire for the year. And then, what, a month and a half or so later, we got the Thomas fire, which made the tea fire look like a party.
Yeah.
So, well, we're in our last 2 minutes here. What are you, any closing thoughts?
Well, you know, what I think is the immediate situation, and I think where people ought to be investing their time, is coming to this this program that the Fire Safe Council is putting on, the Wildfire Evacuation and Survival Workshop at the West Campus of the Santa Barbara City College on the 18th of May, is a place where they can actually interface and create some attention and get some of their concerns across to the agency people and have a discussion. I think that's what we really need, is that communication between.
Right.
And I think from my perspective, that's where the rubber is meeting the road today anyway. And so I'd encourage that.
Well, very good. Well, this has been When, Positive Preparation for Disaster with Ted Adams and Mike Williams. If you have any questions, give us a call, 964-7194, 964-7194, or shoot us an email at community@wildlandresidents.org.
That's 805.
Yeah, 805. And the comments and attitudes and everything else is not necessarily representative of our sponsors, or the California Fire Safe Council, Santa Barbara Fire Safe Council,